This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents An Argumentation of Historians, Book 9 of the Chronicles of St. Mary series. Written by Jodie Taylor, narrated by Zara Ram. Prologue. It's not all about battles and death and violence, you know. Yes, battles and death and violence do tend to be epoch-changing events, but sometimes, just occasionally, some seemingly unimportant event has massive consequences. Ramifications which spread down the centuries, affecting everyone and everything. Very often, people aren't aware at the time, and it's only with the benefit of history in hindsight that the importance of the event is revealed. Take, for example, the year 1536. In particular, take the 24th of January, 1536, Greenwich Palace. A holiday. A nice day out for the kids. Take a picnic. Enjoy the show. Thrill to the spectacle of a Tudor jousting tournament. Catch a glimpse of the king and his court. Nobody would die today. But thousands of people would die as a result of today, because the 24th of January, 1536, was the day when everything changed. Chapter 1. I'd like to say we all got back together again, but that was no longer true. We would never all be back together again. Helen Foster was dead, and I missed her every day. Ian Guthrie had been so badly injured he would never return to the security section. He and Elspeth Gray were leaving to start a new life just as soon as he was well enough. They had a plan, he said, and no, he certainly wasn't going to jeopardise his chances of success by telling an historian. Markham had recovered well, well enough to enjoy all the sympathy and admiration anyway. His tale of saving lives, being blown up and surviving a dramatic crash landing in Constantinople, grew more detailed and more dramatic with every telling. Hawking Hangar was repaired. The roof was back on, and thanks to the heroic efforts of the technical section, we had a few working pods. Enough to get us back in business anyway. It takes a lot to keep St. Mary's down. For his own safety, Matthew, our son, was living in the future, under the guardianship of the Time Police. The supposedly temporary arrangement was stretching on, and I should be doing something about it. But at the moment, I had my hands full with Leon. By mutual agreement, Matthew would stay with the Time Police until we'd managed to apprehend Clive Ronan. I still wasn't sure how I felt about that, and Leon wasn't happy at all. But since St. Mary's had been out of commission for more than 6 months, we'd had to leave capturing Ronan to the Time Police. I couldn't understand how he was continually eluding them, but he was. Useless bloody lumps. But the good news was that Matthew was due for a visit in a few weeks, and we'd take it from there. And Leon. Yes, Leon. He'd been with the Time Police, undergoing a series of operations, and was finally back at St. Mary's, having been detained at their pleasure. For medical reasons, he always hastens to add, not legal ones. He tells people he's a lot more law-abiding than his wife, and I suppose some people who don't know him very well might believe that. He'd been away a long time, though, and there were certain adjustments to be made. On both sides. I think my spectacles came as a bit of a surprise to him, even though they do make me look both intelligent and sexy. He made haste to agree. And, I informed him as he undressed for bed, absolutely brilliant for identifying who you're in bed with. About to pull his T-shirt over his head, he paused and looked around. Who else has been in here? Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, isn't it? Could have been anyone. We'll never know. I had no idea so many people were trying to get you into bed. Neither did I, but thanks to the miracle of modern optics, those days are done. I'm not sure I find that quite as reassuring as you intended. Who said I intended to be reassuring? Joking aside, his recovery had been slow, rather like his current top speed, as I remarked one day. We had just returned from breakfast, and I was about to make him comfortable on the sofa, prior to shooting off to the 1536 briefing. "I'll see you at dinner," he said, parking his walking stick against the coffee table. "Shouldn't you be setting off now?" He sighed. "What are you talking about?" "Well, at the speed you move these days, if you don't set off now, it'll be tomorrow by the time you get there." I was instructed to go and join all the other idiots in the history department. I settled him with a coffee and handed him his newspaper already folded open at the familiar headline, England Slump to Massive Defeat, a headline that could refer to any England performance since 1966. Just to cheer him up, I pointed out how difficult it is to find an article describing our football team's performance which doesn't begin, England Slump to Massive Defeat. He humphed, so I hastily refolded the paper to the science pages and handed it to him. Not a good move. There was talk of the Mars project being delayed again. They'll get there, I said, as he pointed this out. He humphed again. I'll believe that when I see it. I'm wondering if I should stop you drinking coffee. It's making you very grumpy. Haven't you gone to work yet? On my way, I said, whisking myself out of the door. Play nicely with yourself. I think you mean by yourself. I know what I mean. At some point in the day, he would make his way down to Hawking, lower himself painfully into a chair, and preside over whatever it is techies find to do in there all day long. We would meet again for dinner. Often Peterson or Dieter would join us, and we would all chatter bravely, but none of this disguised his slow recovery. He was bored and frustrated. We all work for the Institute of Historical Research at St. Mary's Priory, situated just outside of Rushford. Our main function is to investigate major historical events in contemporary time, although not recently. Our attempts to apprehend the renegade Clive Ronan had gone disastrously wrong, and his revenge had been swift. An hour later, Helen Foster was dead, and he'd kidnapped our baby son, Matthew. Leon had got him back, eventually, but that hadn't been the end of it. Ronan had set off an enormous explosion that had nearly destroyed Hawking, wrecked most of our pods, and caused some very serious injuries. You wouldn't think one person could do so much damage, but I think we all had been guilty of underestimating him. It's when he's cornered that he's at his most dangerous. Anyway, the combined efforts of St. Mary's and the Time Police to capture Ronan had proved unsuccessful. He was still out there somewhere. And we were all here. Peterson, slowly recovering from Helen's death, was our shiny new deputy director. Markham had been made head of security, and I was back on the active list after injuring myself in Constantinople. As Peterson said, we were all very staid and respectable now, as befitted our advancing years. Our days of rocketing around the timeline, enjoying ourselves and evading death by the skin of our teeth, were over and done with. Our lives were about rules, regulations, paperwork, and standing back to let the next generation have their turn. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm laughing. Right, you lot, I said. Greenwich Palace, 24th of January, 1536. A stir of anticipation ran around the room. We were in my office, settling down with the tea and biscuits that would have been provided by my assistant Miss Lee if she had even the faintest idea of what her job entailed. The rule of three again, I said. Three pods with three people in each. Dr. Peterson, Mr. Markham and me in number 8, Mr. Clerk, Mr. Evans and Miss North in number 5, and Mr. Bashford, Mr. Cox and Miss Sykes in number 6. Bashford stirred. I was taking a bit of a risk sending him and Sykes out together. Their already bizarrely informal relationship had been strained past breaking point by the discovery that Bashford had been unfaithful to her. After a spectacular pub crawl one evening, Bashford had somehow become separated from the pack and found himself on the wrong end of a large group of inebriated young men. Fortunately, Angus had turned up. The two of them had fought together and bonded. Angus was now BBF, Bashford's best friend, and slept every night on his wardrobe, both of them oblivious to Sykes's loudly uttered complaints. In the same way we have asymmetric warfare, Bashford and Sykes could be described as an asymmetric couple. Basically, he hadn't got a clue what was going on, although, as Markham had said, since he was usually unconscious for at least half the day, it didn't matter much anyway. Sykes now threw Bashford a look that, had he noticed, would have curled his toenails. Being Bashford, however, he was entirely unaware of his peril. I could only admire his unconcern. She wasn't known as Psycho Sykes for nothing. I resolved to keep an eye on them, and, if things got sticky, I'd swap North for Sykes to keep her and Bashford apart. I sighed. Life never used to be this difficult. On the other hand, I did have a certain amount of sympathy for her. It can't be easy, sharing your man with a chicken. Atherton and Prentice would stay behind on this one, just in case. We discovered the hard way that it's really not a good idea to send all your people off on the same assignment, because then you don't have a rescue team. If, when, this one went tits up, the two of them, together with as many of the security section as we could herd into one pod, would be our backup and our rescue. So, I had historians down one side of the table, bashing away at their scratch pads, the security section down the other, pretending to look cool and fooling no one, with Miss Dottle at the foot and, no surprise there, as close to Peterson as she could get. Her former boss, the idiot Halcombe, was still on leprosy leave, being treated for an illness we all knew he didn't have, leaving his less than faithful lieutenant to hitch her wagon to the St. Mary's Star. She'd enthusiastically participated in several jumps, at least two of which had been unauthorized, and had settled down at St. Mary's as Thirsk's representative on Earth. She could frequently be seen scurrying around with armfuls of files, looking busy and important and happy. Gone was the mousy, dumpy Dottle with the slightly protruding front teeth, the badly styled hair and the droopy cardigans. This Dottle had cut and coloured her hair and wore makeup. She no longer spent her evenings alone in the bar reading romantic fiction about voluptuous young women barely able to keep their clothes on in a crisis, but could frequently be found with the younger historians and techies, clutching a spritzer, flushed with excitement and wine and thoroughly enjoying herself. I often wondered what would happen if, or more probably when, her boss, the idiot Halcombe, came back. She still had a bit of a thing for Peterson, understandably, he said. He was only surprised that it didn't happen more often. Since her passion for him was in much better taste than her passion for the unspeakable Halcombe, people let it go and just grinned when she blushed furiously every time he spoke to her, or walked past, or was even in the same room as her. As for his feelings for her, I had no clue until the day Markham, Peterson and I had bumped into her on our way out of the dining room. Markham was carrying the tea, I had the chocolate, and Peterson had a plate of chips. I can't remember what we were doing that afternoon, but it was obviously something requiring a great deal of strenuous mental effort. She bumped straight into Peterson. Markham and I exchanged knowing glances. "Oh, I'm sorry. Are you all right?" she said, covered in confusion. "Yes," he said faintly, "but I think you might have crushed my chips." It was just a joke, something any of us might have said, but she shot him a look from the corner of her eye, said mischievously, "Oh, is that what you're calling them these days?" Then looked horrified, blushed scarlet, and shot off in some disarray. Peterson watched her go. Markham and I looked at each other. "Shut up," said Peterson, not even looking round. We said nothing. "I mean it," he said. We said nothing. He sighed in exasperation. "You two are so childish, you know." We said nothing. "Oh, for heaven's sake." And he stamped off in the direction lately taken by Miss Dottle. "She's well and truly crushed his chips, hasn't she?" said Markham. And we continued with our afternoon. Anyway, back to the briefing. "Something interesting to celebrate our return to normal working," I said, bringing up a few images. "The infamous jousting tournament at Greenwich Palace, the one possibly held to celebrate, if that's the word I want, the death of Henry's first queen, Catherine of Aragon. Things are going quite well for Henry. The inconvenient wife has died. His current wife, that's Anne Boleyn, is pregnant, and this could be his longed-for heir. However, as we know, the king comes a massive cropper, and, for him, nothing is ever quite the same afterwards. He incurs a serious head injury, which, supposedly, leads to a complete personality change." "Debatable," said North. "If you're going to say he developed tendencies toward extreme paranoia and cruelty, it's only fair to say he had all those before the accident. Remember, he's already executed Thomas More, and his harshness to Queen Catherine and Princess Mary was well documented long before he fell off his horse." "I don't agree," said Sykes at once. Well, she wouldn't, would she? The two of them never agreed over anything. "All contemporary reports say the king was sporty, fit, popular and generous. He was generally reckoned to epitomise all the kingly virtues. It was only after his accident that he started to develop tyrannical tendencies. Wrong, argued North, and we all sat back to let them get on with it. He certainly didn't enjoy perfect health. He's already suffered bouts of smallpox and malaria. There's a possibility he might even have been suffering from syphilis. There's no proof of that, Sykes said scornfully. He wasn't exactly rotting away in front of people, was he? His leg wouldn't heal. It was a varicose ulcer caused by wearing his garters too tightly, countered Sykes, the light of battle in her eye. They don't heal quickly even today. It wasn't the first accident he'd suffered. He'd sustained a previous head wound on another occasion when he forgot to lower his visor. He didn't lose consciousness on that occasion, though. For this one, he was unconscious for over 2 hours. And when he woke up, everyone agreed his personality had changed. He became grasping, covetous, and... He's a Tudor, North said scornfully. He was all that anyway. Experts agree he definitely exhibited signs of brain damage when he believed those ridiculous stories about Anne Boleyn's adultery. Really? Well, she was no better than she should be. Suppose, just the 1 minute, that the stories are true. Desperate for an heir, Anne has an affair. And who better than her brother? Keeps it in the family, I suppose, said Sykes nastily. Well, he's never going to betray her, is he? Yes, I know the prevailing view is that she was innocent, but this is the woman who refused to settle for being his mistress, held out for marriage, had no qualms when Henry divorced his wife, whom she had served as lady-in-waiting, by the way, or when he broke with Rome, or when he executed one of his closest friends, and she played a major part in Wolsey's downfall. All she has to do is produce a male heir, and her position is secure forever. Is it too much of a stretch to imagine that with so much at stake she wouldn't stoop to a little adultery? Enough, I said, before they climbed over the table and started having a go at each other. I often wonder if other professions have this difficulty. I mean, do you ever get a geologist shouting, I tell you, it's oolitic limestone, you idiot, and his colleague yelling back, No, it's not. Surely any imbecile can see it's an ultramafic, ultrapotassic, intrusive rock dominated by mafic phenocrysts in a feldspar groundmass. Are you a complete moron? I once mentioned my theory about non-historian debates to the Chancellor of the University of Thirsk, and I could hear her laughing all the way down the corridor. Yes, said Clerk, leaping into the breach, bless him. Well, it's a bad year all round. His first wife dies. His second wife miscarries that vital heir. Cromwell finds evidence of adultery. There's all the scandal of the trial, and Henry's virility is mocked in court. He executes Anne Boleyn. His illegitimate and only son, Henry Fitzroy, dies. The Pilgrimage of Grace kicks off. It just goes on and on. Catherine's death wasn't a bad thing for Henry, objected Sykes. It was for Anne Boleyn, said North. She was Anne's protection. Even Henry VIII couldn't take a third wife with 2 still living. Be that as it may, I said, dragging them back on track again, we will, with luck, be able to form an opinion as to his physical state, if not his mental one. I want details of how he's received by the crowd. Is he still popular? Do the common people love him? We know Anne Boleyn's not there, which is a shame, but Miss North and Miss Clerk, you'll be opposite the royal stand, and I'd like you to pay particular attention to what happens there. Is Jane Seymour present? Does Henry single her out in any way? They nodded, bashing away at their scratch pads. Miss Sykes and Mr. Bashford, I'd like you near Henry's pavilion. We need to know if they take him straight to the palace after the accident, or whether they take him to his tent first. What sort of condition is he in? Will you be able to see if they administer any medical treatment? I expect they'll try and take off his helmet. Not a problem, since there weren't any neck or spinal injuries, so try and get a good look at him then. Dr. Peterson and I will concentrate on the accident itself. We'll be on the side stand, because I'm betting that's the side Henry will choose. He's very vain, and that's where people will get their best view of him. Regarding costumes, we'll be our usual middle-of-the-road selves, too prosperous to kick but not rich enough to rob. Ladies, woolen dresses, linen undergarments, belts with pouches for anything important. Rules regarding hair are beginning to relax, but cover it anyway, just to be on the safe side. Gentlemen, woolen tunics, knee trousers, stockings and shoes. You know the drill? Report to Mrs. Enderby later today, please. She's expecting you. Any questions? They shook their heads. In that case, thank you, everyone. Report to Hawking at 10 a.m. Tuesday. Chapter 2. I assembled my teams outside number 8, and we checked each other over for forgotten jewellery, inadvertently acquired tattoos, wristwatches, etc., because it was some time since we'd done this. I was actually quite nervous. There was a lot riding on today. According to Dr. Bairstow, the equivalent of the third world's debt had been spent on us, and we'd better prove we were worth it. Looking around, Hawking seemed almost back to normal. Exploding pods had gouged great lumps out of the walls, but that had all been smoothed over. The crater in the floor had been filled in, and the permanent roof was on. All the electrics, together with what Dieter had insisted on referring to as the fiddly bits, had taken considerably longer, though, and we still had only 4 working pods. Number 1 had been cannibalized to repair the others. Number 2 was almost back together again. Number 3 was still U/S, unserviceable. But not for long. Number 4 had been blown out of existence and was being completely rebuilt, as was TB2, our transport pod. The jury was still out over whether number 7 could be saved. Numbers 5, 6 and 8 were ready to go. All the pods had been, or were, in the process of being upgraded and enlarged, because over the years we'd changed the way we staffed our assignments. When I first arrived at St. Mary's, the norm had been short assignments staffed by 2, possibly 3 people, usually historians. These days our assignments were often longer and more complex, and the inclusion of the security and technical sections, where appropriate, meant we needed larger pods. Numbers 5, 6 and 8 had been redesigned and could now hold anything from 5 to 8 people. We had comfortable seats. Well, we had slightly less uncomfortable seats. The locker space was better designed and, in an effort to combat the hot, dry and frequently uncomfortable atmosphere, the ventilation system had been upgraded. Obviously, there had been a certain amount of grumbling over these changes. Historians are by nature conservative and resistant to modernization, although the retention of tea-making facilities, the introduction of even more cup holders, and a specifically designated area for the biscuit tin had gone a long way towards smoothing ruffled feathers. Before anyone asks, they, the pods, I mean, not the historians, do still stink of cabbage, with an underlying smell of defeated air freshener, and the toilets still don't work properly. I'd complained about all this to Leon, who had responded that, for reasons which escaped him, the priority was getting historians there and back safely, and you can't have everything. I took a final look around Hawking and spotted Leon in his office, frowning at a set of blueprints. I waved. He smiled for me alone and waved back. "Okay, guys, let's go." We climbed inside our pods and stowed our gear. Mr. Lindstrom gave the console one last check. "Ready when you are, Max. Good luck." He closed the door behind him. I sat myself down, wriggled my bum in the unfamiliar seat, and checked the readouts. Here we go. "Computer, initiate jump." "Jump, initiated." The world went white. And here we were, bang on the nose. Greenwich, 1536. Fat Harry's Anus Horribilis. The place was heaving. That's not a particularly historical term, but very accurate. There were people everywhere, all streaming in the same general direction. The noise was incredible. People shouted to each other. Street hawkers bellowed their wares at the tops of their voices. Women shrieked for their children to come here and for their husbands to go away. Dogs barked madly. The occasional horn sounded as important people tried to shoulder their way through the solid mass of suddenly uncooperative people. Arguments broke out all around us, and the smell could strip paint. We stood together in a tight group outside number 8, getting our bearings and waiting for our sense of smell to shut down. Occasionally someone would stagger as we were buffeted by those trying to get past. "Okay," I said. "Everyone knows where to go and what to do when they get there. Communal link. Look out for each other, and for God's sake, try to stay out of trouble." I don't know why my gaze fell on Bashford at that moment. It just did. He gazed reproachfully back. Sykes nodded understandingly. "Good luck, everyone." They dispersed, and I found myself with Peterson and Markham grinning at me.
"The dream team," said Markham happily.
That wasn't usually the phrase that described us, but I was so happy to be as nearly back to normal as we could ever be that I didn't argue. And, besides, it was surely just coincidence that no one else ever wanted to be on our team. We were the equivalent of the puny kid with specs and the funny rash who always gets picked last. There was no question of getting lost. We only had to follow everyone else through the narrow streets. I would have liked a little time to study the architecture, which in this case would have consisted of wondering how those houses were still standing, so warped were the timbers, but I had to watch where I put my feet. Not only were the streets deep in the usual Tudor debris, but such bits as were paved were covered in greasy, ankle-turning cobbles. We linked arms and allowed ourselves to be carried along with the crowd. Everyone seemed very cheerful, no doubt looking forward to the colour and spectacle and excitement and probable bloodshed, and, on top of all that, we'd get to see the king. The king! The legendary Henry VIII! Fat Harry himself! We found the lists with no trouble. A large level area of grass that had been roped off, with a wide wooden stepped stand, festooned with crimson, gold and purple bunting, set up to run along one side. In the centre of the stand, two magnificent canopied chairs had been set up. One was very much larger than the other, one for the king and one for the queen, although we knew she wouldn't be here today, and nor were we sure whether Henry would preside over the tournament before taking part. A central barrier, the tilt, ran down the length of the field. It was designed to keep the horses straight and give the riders a better chance of hitting each other. A thick layer of sand covered the ground on each side. I couldn't decide whether it was to give the horses a better grip or to soak up the inevitable blood. The lists were surrounded on three sides. Nobles and royalty sat in the big stand. Lesser mortals, dogs and historians stood around the other two sides, using their elbows to get to the front for a good view. The fourth side was a mass of brightly coloured tents, or pavilions, I suppose, would be a more accurate term. Each pavilion was decorated in the livery of its owner. Front and centre was Henry's pavilion, easily distinguished not only by the royal arms hanging limply overhead, but because it was twice the size of anyone else's.
"A spot of overcompensation, do you think?" muttered Peterson. "That and the infamous codpiece, of course."
Behind the pavilions, an army of armourers, blacksmiths and farriers were working overtime on last-minute repairs. I could see the glow of braziers, bright on this grey day, and hear the metallic beat of hammer on anvil. Caparisoned horses were being led around, snorting with excitement and kicking out at anyone they didn't like the look of. Some of them had a very nasty look in their eye, and most people were giving them a wide berth.
"I'm not going over there,"
muttered Markham, never at ease with anything in the animal kingdom. "Look at the size of the feet on that one." Entertainers, conjurers, ladies offering a few minutes' affection for a really very reasonable fee, musicians and piemen were working their way through the spectators, their shouts adding to the considerable din. People laughed and money changed hands. A considerable number of casks of ale had obviously been broached, because that's always helpful when trying to keep public order, isn't it? And I could see and smell various animals roasting on spits. I caught a glimpse of a muddy mongrel racing past with a lump of part-cooked meat in its mouth, closely pursued by two or three other larger dogs. His little legs were going like the clappers, and I hoped he made it to safety. Even the weather was fine. It wasn't warm. England in January is never warm, but it wasn't raining, and there was no wind. Pennants hung limply in the still air, but it wasn't unpleasant. No frost covered the grass on which we were preparing to picnic. More importantly, the sky was flat and grey. There was no sunshine to dazzle riders and ruin their aim, an equal advantage to all. And still the crowds were pouring in. I palmed my recorder and got what I could. We were surrounded by people from all walks of life. Townspeople, merchants, tradesmen and their families, locals and those who'd made the journey from outlying villages. There was colour everywhere, especially in the stands where the nobility sat in comfort, being served wine and sweetmeats. You didn't catch them sprawling on the cold ground like us. When I judged they'd had enough time to get themselves into position, I called the others. Clerk reported his team was well situated, directly opposite the stand, and that he could see us and I should pull my skirt down. I grinned and told him his codpiece was slipping. "We've got a good view from here," he said.
"Well, keep your eye on Norfolk," I said. "I especially want footage of him racing off to break the bad news to the Queen."
"Copy that,"
he said calmly, and closed the link. Sykes reported that she and her team were exactly where they wanted to be, which was within a stone's throw of the King's tent. Bashford was still conscious and there were no chickens around, so she was hopeful of a successful outcome. I could hear his indignant, "Hey!" in the background. We'd brought packs and baskets with us, and so, just like everyone else, we were having a bit of a picnic. The usual St. Mary's staple fare, thick brown bread, a giant wedge of cheese, and apples, all washed down with water. It would have to keep us going all day, too. With that and all the running I do, you'd think I'd be as thin as a rake. But I'm not. I just can't understand it. Oh, and there was a large slab of fruit and nut chocolate hidden in the bottom of the basket, because I need to keep up my sugar levels. Munching a piece of cheese, I was panning around and getting some great footage of people and what they were wearing. Most people had doublets and dresses inclined towards russet and brown, especially the poorer people, because the dyes were cheap and easily obtained. The middle classes, merchants and the like, wore long gowns of dark, rich colours. The sumptuary laws laid down very strict rules as to which fabrics and furs which class of people could use. For the more expensive reds, greens and blues, you had to look to the nobility in the stands. Beside me, Peterson was dictating details of the appearance and composition of the common spectators, and I was busy recording details of the high-born ladies in the stand, their long, full sleeves and ornate headdresses. One or two of them looked almost exactly like the queens in a pack of playing cards. Some hair was visible, especially among the younger women. There was a great deal of fur worn, white, cream, dark, and obviously mostly for show because even in January, most women wore their cloaks thrown back so people could admire their dresses. They would be wearing their best clothes for the occasion. I wondered how many had dressed to catch the King's eye. Anne Boleyn was pregnant, but some reports suggested that the King had begun to tire of her already. Speaking of which, I craned my neck to see if I could spot Jane Seymour in the chattering stands. We'd all studied the Holbein portraits and sketches before setting out, but I wasn't that confident of recognising her even if she was here, so we would get a record of everyone here today and sort it out when we got home. It's a funny thing about Holbein's sketches of Henry's wives. To my modern eyes, only Anne of Cleves looks even remotely pretty. I suppose that's the changing face of beauty. No wonder women can never catch up. I myself would probably have been extremely desirable about 20,000 years ago, when the only competition would have been from a shaggy mammoth or a toothless old hag of 15. Just as we were finishing our lunch, the warm-up crew appeared, parading around the arena, playing instruments, singing and dancing. We packed away our picnic and got to work. Minstrels, all men, stood in the centre. Some had stringed instruments, others played pipes or what looked like recorders. They were actually very good. Around them whirled dancers and acrobats, all men, jumping and tumbling in time to the music. The crowd was eager to be pleased and clapped and cheered every one of them, as did we. They left the field to great applause. Peterson turned to me. "All right?" I nodded. I was. I was dry and comfortable and enjoying myself, as was everyone else. It was good to be back at work. I'd missed this. But we were up and running again. Hawking was repaired. We had our pods back. Leon was recovering and Matthew was safe. We would work something out with the time police. It had been a bad year, but it was over now. I could look forward to the future. All around me, people were craning their necks. They were waiting for the King. We were all waiting for the King. We were waiting for Henry Tudor, by the grace of God, King of England and France, Defender of the Faith, Lord of Ireland and of the Church of England in earth, under Jesus Christ, Supreme Head. If you ask anyone who is England's most famous king, nearly everyone will say Henry VIII. Not Henry V, although he's my favourite, or Richard the Lionheart,
a right royal plonker, if ever there was one, or mighty Edward III, hero of Crécy and Poitiers, or Edward II, the worst king ever in the entire history of kinging, or Charles II, who was sex on legs, apparently. It's always Henry VIII, man and monster combined. And we were about to see him. There was a huge air of excitement and anticipation, and that was just me. We had speculated on whether the king would open the tournament and then take part, or whether he was already suited up for the opening bouts and would delegate the opening ceremony to someone else. The atmosphere was electric. A crowd this size could never be completely silent, but there was certainly a hushed air of expectation. Of course, he opened it himself. This was Henry Tudor, and if it was one thing he loved above everything, it was attention. To be the centre of the spectacle, to have all eyes on him, to have the admiration of men and the adoration of women. Trumpets sounded in the distance. He was coming. We scrambled to our feet. I had my recorder ready. Okay, people, this is it. Good luck, everyone. My words were nearly lost in the huge roar of approbation and excitement. He was here. The trumpets sounded again, closer this time. The crowd was parting. And here he was, at last, leading the parade into the arena. Trumpets blared again and the crowd went into overdrive, and he knew how to work them. Heading his entourage of brightly coloured courtiers, he paraded slowly around the ring, waving graciously and smiling at the pretty girls. Shouts of "Harry for England!" and "God save His Grace!" rang out around us. This was it. He was here, right in front of us. This was Henry VIII, Henry Tudor himself, here, not 20 feet away, close enough for me to see the fine detail of his tunic and the feather in his hat. He wasn't yet as fat as he would be. He was nowhere near that yet, but he was still heavier than most. He was a big man, well over 6 feet, and his physical presence was bigger still because he dressed to impress. He wore a doublet of deep, vibrant red, with a thickly padded red and gold fur-lined short coat over the top. Rather dashing scarlet gloves were setting a new fashion right at this very moment. A soft hat concealed most of his hair, but yes, he was ginger, just like me. Yay! I shouted, jumped up and down and waved like any star-struck teenager drooling over a boy band, and for one moment, just for one moment, he looked directly at me. Oh my God! Henry Tudor looked at me! I grabbed Tim's arm. Tim! He looked at me! Did you see?
Steady on, Max. You're a married woman, you know.
The king looked at me, Markham! Did you see? Of course not! He shouted over the roar of the crowd. I'm doing my job and watching your backs, not falling about like an hysterical groupie. Seriously, Max, I'm ashamed of you. I didn't care. But the king looked at me!
The king looks at every woman under 70. Said Peterson severely. There's nothing special about you. I still didn't care, but one of us should get on with the job, so I palmed my recorder again and got stuck in. His clothes today were not as laden with jewels as those in his portraits, but he wore a large ruby in his hat and a magnificent golden chain around his neck. Jewels studded his garters as well, which were cutting tightly into his legs. The garters were very smart, but they were known to be the cause of many of his problems. He had good legs. Actually, he had very good legs, and he showed them off with tight-fitting stockings with even tighter garters to hold them up. He wouldn't want to spoil the effect by having his stockings bunched around his ankles. But those garters would give him, and possibly had already given him, the varicose ulcers that would plague him throughout his life and play a large part in turning him from man to monster. Jeweled garters aside, everything he wore was designed to catch the eye and invite admiration. He was still extraordinarily handsome. In his youth he must have stopped traffic, but he was just beginning to be jowly. I suspected he was extremely vain, although he had good reason to be, but watching him now as he paraded around the crowd, basking in their adoration, it was easy to imagine the dismay his increasing weight and lack of physical attractiveness would cause him. Maybe dismay was too mild a word. Anguish, maybe? Despair?
To have been the most handsome prince in Christendom, the best at everything, to come first in everything, to be admired and envied, and then to deteriorate into the bloated, paranoid wreck of a man he would become, lashing out at friend and foe alike. Indeed, no longer able to distinguish one from the other, what must he have seen when he regarded himself in the mirror? Or did that massive self-confidence dwindle into self-delusion so that he always saw himself as a young, virile, handsome king? He was a big man, in every sense of the word. He stood head and shoulders above those around him. The crowd was cheering, and he was lapping it up. Judging from their reactions to him, at this point in his life he was still hugely popular. He was everyone's idea of what a king should be.
"Not sure there's a lot of hair under that hat," said Peterson, himself the proud possessor of a hairstyle frequently resembling a wind-blown haystack. And, as the king moved on and the glamour faded, I could see he limped slightly.
"The leg!" I said in excitement. "He already has the leg ulcer!"
He was really enjoying himself, waving to the crowd, eyeing up the women, tossing sweetmeats to children. Well, actually he stood, head thrown back, legs spread wide, in that famous stance, and several lackeys threw sweetmeats for the kids, but the thought was there. Those in the stand rose to their feet as he entered. There was another fanfare. The crowd fell silent in anticipation. The king took his position, gazed majestically around him, raised his handkerchief, paused dramatically, and then let it fall. Another huge roar went up, and, to yet another brassy fanfare from the trumpets, we were off. The first event was an archery competition, designed, I guess, to give the king time to nip off and climb into his armour. We watched several heats. One was between a team of professional soldiers against the locals. Each flight was cheered or booed, depending on which side of the ground you were standing. The locals lost their bout to a great deal of good-natured heckling. A small purse and a keg were presented to the winners. And then, this was it. They were bringing up the horses. Grooms led them between the tents. It took 2 grooms per horse just to hold them back. Riders were climbing into their saddles and lining up for the parade. We joined the general surge forwards. We didn't have a lot of choice, actually. We were packed in tighter than sardines. The crowd was very obliging. Those at the front sat on the ground so those behind could see. Peddlers passed among the crowd, selling last-minute sweetmeats and souvenirs and generally standing on people. There were 6 riders, 2 teams of 3. Each man would fight all those on the other team. 9 bouts altogether. Not that events that afternoon would get that far. I looked at the excited faces around me. This would be a good afternoon's entertainment for them. The excitement of the joust and the presence of the king himself. I wondered how much of his courtship of Jane Seymour was popular knowledge. Perhaps we weren't the only ones craning our necks for a sight of his new girlfriend and possible future queen. Yes, everyone was looking forward to an afternoon of fun and excitement. And apart from us, no one knew what would happen today, how it would all end, how everything would change. The riders paraded around the ring. Henry's team, which he obviously captained, was known as the Challengers. One of the permanent members was Charles Brandon, Earl of Suffolk and the King's brother-in-law. He was generally reckoned to be the best jouster in the land and was always very careful to lose to Henry, but not by too much. Henry had a temper even before his accident. Brandon wasn't here today, hence the teams of only 3 instead of the usual 4. I guess the other 2 would be Nicholas Carew and Henry Borcia, Earl of Essex. The heralds had announced their names, but the noise was so great I couldn't make them out. The composition of the other team, known as the Answerers, was unknown to us. There's no record of the combatants, but we would record their liveries and check them on our return. Henry was easily the biggest man there, and easily recognisable in his magnificent armour. The popular picture of a warhorse, or destrier, is of some colossal lumbering beast capable of carrying a man encased in heavy armour, and that is true, they were immensely strong, but they were also highly manoeuvrable. They had to be. No one would go into battle on a horse too big to move at faster than a trot. None of them were even as big as modern shire horses,
except for Henry's horse, which was huge and, I suspected, was fed on red meat. He was a magnificent black beast, currently raring to go, frothing at the mouth and working up a heavy sweat. It was typical of Henry that he would ride a horse that took three grooms to control. The horse was drawing nearly as many admiring glances as the king, which, as Peterson said, was all very well, but when you knew this horse was going to be crashing down on top of him at God knows what speed... Henry opened the batting, magnificent in his ornate armour which glinted gold even on this dull day. His horse, guessing the moment had come, was rearing and plunging. There were now four men hanging off him. Henry sat easily in his saddle. The crowd was going mad with excitement, as were we. I don't know who was his first adversary. His badge was quartered with black chevrons on a white background. He stood to our left. The king was on our right. They took up their lances. Drums rolled and the trumpets sounded. Henry's horse half-reared, scattering grooms in all directions, and they were off. It was over in seconds. The two great horses thundered full tilt towards each other. No one held back. Their enormous hooves flung great divots of mud and sand high into the air. The earth shook beneath my feet. I mean, really shook. And I'm married to Leon Farrell, so I know earth-shaking when I feel it. As the two riders levelled their lances, I found I was holding my breath. Necks outstretched, ears laid back and foam flying from their bits, the two horses met at the middle of the tilt, the central barrier, with an almighty great crash. The rider on the far side of the tilt tumbled backwards over his horse's rump to sprawl on his back, unmoving. First blood to Henry and his team. Most of the crowd cheered wildly, jumping up and down and waving their arms. A few groaned and made rude gestures, possibly concerning their favourite's ancestry, or lack of it. Men ran towards the fallen body and heaved him to his feet. He stood, swaying gently. The crowd applauded politely. He raised his arm to the king, presumably either to acknowledge defeat or possibly to check it was still attached. Henry, meanwhile, was doing his lap of honour, graciously acknowledging the cheers of his subjects. Would he pause at the stand and search the crowd for one face in particular? Nope. He just swept on past, visor up, waving and smiling, basking in the admiration. The next bout was already lining up as Henry swept from the lists. I watched him dismount fairly easily from his horse, clap someone on the shoulder, accept a goblet of wine, and stride off to watch. There were very short intervals between each joust, just enough time to draw away those unable to move under their own steam and put fresh sand over the blood. The king's team won the next bout as well. I could see Peterson meticulously recording events in the arena while I followed the king as he sat outside his tent, drinking and laughing. Sykes would be down there somewhere doing the same, and Clerk's team would also be covering the action. Double coverage, belt and braces. And the security team I knew would be watching our backs. They lost the next one. The horse on the king's team, nervous before it even entered the ring and sweating heavily, veered sideways at the last moment. The crowd roared in disapproval. This was failure to present, a serious offence. The crowd, all of them experts in a field in which they could never compete, booed loudly. And at the entrance to the arena, the night marshal recorded the foul on his wooden board and indicated a rematch. Both sides pulled up with difficulty, turned around, settled their lances, and set off again. I think the king's rider must have been concentrating too much on his horse because he was unseated easily, flying through the air and hitting the ground with enough impact to bounce. "Ouch!" said Peterson, wincing. The rider was dragged, unconscious, to his tent, and two men scurried up with more buckets of fresh sand. His horse, the cause of all the trouble, was fleeing around the ring, reins trailing, until cornered against the high-fronted stand. Someone flung a sack over its head. "They're not going to shoot him, are they?" said Markham anxiously. I think that despite every horse on the planet having him on their hit list, he's actually quite fond of the species in general. "Doubt it," said Peterson, shaking his head and checking his recorder. "He's only young. Probably the first time out. A mistake to bring him today, but maybe his rider wanted to catch the king's eye, which he has done, but for all the wrong reasons." Indeed, we could see the rider being carried into his tent.
Who's next? Said Markham.
Well, I said, if they keep to the same order, it's Henry again. And if it is, then this is the big one. They did, and it was.
Chapter 3. There was a lot of cheering as Henry emerged from his pavilion, accompanied by some half a dozen favoured acquaintances. The king himself appeared to be in excellent form, tossing a remark over his shoulder that made them roar with laughter. He accepted another goblet of something from a page whose hair he ruffled so vigorously that the lad staggered. He tossed back the contents in one go, and, with some assistance, heaved himself onto his horse, who, despite the massive weight on his back, skidded sideways and appeared to be making every effort to dump his sovereign lord into the mud. There was a great deal more laughter. Apparently this was not unusual behaviour. The laughing group accompanied the king to the arena. Shouts of encouragement and good luck followed on behind him. I wondered if Henry ever thought about what might have happened if he'd let that final bout go. What would have been different? If Anne Boleyn did not miscarry, if she was delivered of a healthy son, if their marriage somehow survived, Mary might not have been queen, nor Elizabeth, and Edward might never have been born at all. Jane Seymour would probably have lived. It was Henry's obsessive care of Jane that caused him to order male doctors to attend the birth, and they missed the piece of placenta left lodged inside her. Men, in those days, were not experts in childbirth, it being an area best left to women, whereas any competent midwife would have sussed it immediately and probably saved her life. The ramifications went on and on. I foresaw a massive game of what if over a margarita or two that evening. Henry's challenger was a big man, although not as big as the king. I wonder what might he have done if he hadn't been king. With his talents and physical presence, would he, could he, ever have played second fiddle to his older brother, the shadowy and little-known Arthur? His opponent this morning rode a thick-set brown horse, very big around the hindquarters. Peterson spent a couple of moments describing his livery. We'd try and identify him when we got back, because there's no record of the king's unlucky opponent, and I stayed with the king. The horses were already straining at their bits, tossing their grooms around like so many straw dummies. The marshal had the sense not to keep them waiting. The thunder of cheering and shouting drowned out the drums and trumpets, and I never heard the signal, but someone must have given it, because the big brown horse was already moving. A fraction of a second later, and from a standing start, so was Henry. They galloped furiously towards each other. The noise was tremendous. And then for Henry, for Queen Anne, Mark Smeaton, George Boleyn, even Jane Seymour, everything went wrong. Everything went very, very wrong. Off to my left, there was a scuffle in the crowd. Even over the clamour, I could hear men shouting. I turned for a better view, and as I did so, I heard something that to me sounded very much like the crack of a gunshot. Henry's horse shied sideways. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion. His opponent's lance hit Henry's helmet with a tremendous crash that pushed him out of the saddle. He began to topple to one side. His horse, severely unbalanced, staggered sideways, tipping Henry even further. I suspected he was already unconscious, because he was literally hanging from the saddle. His horse was strong and struggling to stay on his feet, but Henry was a big man, and armour isn't light. The king went down first, with a metallic clang that reverberated off the stands, and then, with a scream that was dreadful to hear, his enormous horse crashed to the ground as well. Right on top of him. It was a massive fall. And at the speed they were travelling, both horse and rider, entangled together, skidded along the ground for a good 20 feet, gouging a path in the sand and mud. Afterwards, we agreed that probably the only reason Henry survived was that the ground was soft and, to some extent, cushioned his fall. Nothing, however, could save him from the crushing weight of half a ton of thrashing horse on top of him. For a few seconds after the impact, there was a shock of silence. And then the screaming began. Turmoil. Panic. People surged around. We were pushed to and fro in the confusion. I was aware someone had hold of the back of my dress, keeping me in place, and I hoped it was Markham.
I just kept recording, and I knew Peterson would be doing the same. That's our job. Markham would keep us safe. That's his. Women were crying. Children screamed as they were knocked over in the crush, and then their mothers screamed too. People were shouting that the king was dead, and it was at this moment that I suddenly saw things from Henry's point of view. Yes, people were shocked and horrified at his accident, but now we saw a glimpse of just how precarious was the Tudor hold on England. Henry was only the second of an upstart line. He had no male heir, and right now he might be dead. The death of a monarch and the accession of a new one is always a perilous time. I didn't mind betting that the thought uppermost in people's minds was, the king is dead and he has no heir. There would still be people alive who would remember the War of the Roses, when Plantagenet fought Plantagenet for the throne. With no clear heir, challenges for the succession would arise. The Scots would sweep from the north, the French would be across the Channel as soon as they could get their anchors up. This was Henry's nightmare come true. People condemn his efforts to get a son, but without a clear heir, an orderly and peaceful transfer of the crown would be impossible. There would be chaos, certainly. Perhaps even civil war. No wonder people were panicking. We were on the communal link. I could hear clerks shouting at someone, and someone shouting back. A full-scale fight seemed to be breaking out around him, but no time for that now. Evans was with him. He'd make sure they were okay. Up in the stands, people were on their feet. Women were covering their faces. No one had swooned, but then again, women don't swoon half as often as men think they do. Yes, I myself have fainted once or twice, but usually it's been a tactical move. I jerked my attention back to Henry's horse, which was screaming in pain and thrashing around trying to get up. I could only imagine the damage he was doing to his rider. People ran to the fallen king, who lay ominously still. Two men were dragging at the king's helmet. The field medic in me screamed a silent protest, but there was nothing we could do, or should do. The records show he hadn't incurred any spinal injuries. Besides, removing the king's helmet gave us a glimpse of his face. Eyes closed and deadly white. His hair was plastered to his head and dark with sweat. I panned in for a close-up, trying to find which part of his head he'd injured so Dr. Stone could assess the possibility of brain damage. Men with sharp knives cut away the stirrups, and they dragged the horse to his feet. White-eyed with terror and covered in mud all down one side, he was bleeding badly from several deep gashes to his shoulder and flanks. From the king's armour, probably. Henry's enormous saddle had slipped halfway around the horse's belly, and a brave man slipped underneath to cut the girths. Two russet-clad grooms led the horse away. He was limping and shying at everything in sight, but seemed otherwise unharmed. I don't know what happened to him. The king, still in his armour, was lifted onto a board. It took 8 men to carry him away, and even then they were staggering with the weight. I said softly, "Sykes, he's coming your way." "On it," she said. "We're right by his tent. There's people racing towards us clutching bundles, possibly doctors, although given current medical procedures, he'd probably be better off with a vet. We've set up sound recorders to try and listen to what will happen inside. Good work." I closed the link and left them to get on with it. Everywhere I looked, people were crying, men and women. Already the cry had gone up. "The king is dead! The king is dead!" We were only one step away from outright panic. I looked for someone to take charge, to initiate some sort of damage control, to contain the rumours that the king was dead, because if they didn't... Peterson touched my arm. "Over there." Someone was on it. I don't know who. Heralds were making their way through the crowds, shouting, "The king lives! King lives!" But all in vain. No one was listening. If anything, the panic was growing worse. Already, in my imagination, the Duke of Norfolk was racing to the Queen's chambers to fling at her without warning the news that the king was dead. This would be the moment when she too would realise how fragile was the framework of her life. In her arrogance, she had made enemies everywhere, and without Henry's protection, they would begin to close in. The only thing keeping her safe was that she carried the king's child. In 4 days' time, she would lose that child. He would have been a boy. The boy that would have solved all of Henry's problems.
The boy that might, just might, have saved Anne's life. As it was, she would lose her child, and in 5 months' time, her head. The king would become engaged to Jane Seymour the very next day. Around the field, the marshals were vigorously dispersing the spectators, breaking up crowds of gossiping people. Despite our protests, which were lost in the protests of many, we were pushed out of the wrong exit. We were now